You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
We're talking Cardinals baseball today on this Wednesday, the 15th of February. It's Matt Wehmeyer joined by Cardinals reporter Jennifer Langosch. And Jennifer, the Cardinals making some big-time news for all the wrong reasons, unfortunately. Alex Reyes, the news coming down on this Wednesday that he is indeed going to miss the entire 2017 season, as the 22-year-old is going to require Tommy John surgery. He'd complained of elbow discomfort for a couple of days, I believed, and underwent the MRI. And it revealed a complete tear of the UCL in his throwing right elbow. So, Jen, it's crushing. You know, we were just commenting a moment ago that, you know, just as a fan separating ourselves from our media duties, you want to see this guy throw. He was so electric last year, hitting 97, 98 routinely. We're not going to see that here in 2017. And to have this happen for a second straight year, it was Lance Lynn last year. He underwent TJ surgery, missed all 2016. It's just got to be crushing for this team that they're snake bitten once again.
Yeah, I mean, and it's certainly, you know, especially disappointing the fact that they couldn't even make it through their first spring training workout without sending their top prospect out for an MRI. And as you mentioned, the results within 24 hours coming back was really the worst of news for the Cardinals, who, you know, weren't promising Alex Reyes a spot in the rotation on opening day, but nonetheless, we're certainly expecting him to be a key contributor in some role at some point during the year. And, you know, yeah, I mean, I think as baseball fans, you want to see the best young players in the game rise to the major league stage and be able to watch them. And, you know, Alex Reyes, you know, at least in my opinion, was going to enter this year probably as the favorite to win the Rookie of the Year award. He was recently ranked by MLB.com as the top pitching prospect in all of baseball. So really unfortunate now that everybody's going to have to wait until at least 2018 to see him on the mound. The only good news maybe in the timing of this is that when you think about Tommy John surgery and the recovery that comes after it, a lot of these pitchers do return to competitive play in about 12, 13 months, which if he has the surgery this week, as he's expected to, could put him healthy entering spring training next year and then, of course, entering the 2018 season. But it's going to test the Cardinals' rotation depth, certainly. And as you mentioned, it's becoming an all-too-familiar sight to the organization to have general manager John Mozeliak here at spring training announce a season-ending injury to one of his players.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, to be blunt, it sucks. I mean, it really does suck for him, for the team, and for people that wanted to see this guy pitch, and we're not going to have that until at some point in 2018. And, Jen, in talking to a guy who is so young and has his entire career in front of him, he's only 22, how is he handling this? You know, I don't know if it's tougher, you know, for a veteran to go through this who has a track record or for a younger guy who, even though he only has limited exposure on the big league stage, they do have youth on their side. Does that soften the blow? Like, you know, what's his attitude right now?
Yeah, well, you took the words out of his mouth because his words today was, it sucks. you know, he's really disappointed, and especially talking to him today, the news was still very raw. I know he had already found his way over to teammate Adam Wainwright to talk to Wainwright about this, because let's not forget that it was spring training of 2011 that Adam Wainwright was diagnosed with the same injury and underwent Tommy John surgery and missed that season. So, I mean, there's always risk with that surgery, and I think that's maybe the thing he's most fearful of is the fact that his career is just getting started at the age of 22, and you never are sure how you're going to come back from this procedure. It's also kind of a gut punch in that this was the first major league spring training that Alex Reyes was going to participate in. I mean, last spring, because he was serving the suspension for the positive drug test, he was not in big league camp. He was not able to pitch in Grapefruit League play. So this is going to be his opportunity to kind of go through the motions in the Major League clubhouse, get acclimated to all his potentially new teammates. And here he is now going to be going through the rehab process instead. So he held his head high, disappointed too. He won't be able to participate in the World Baseball Classic, which he had been looking forward to. But I mean, I also think that just where we are in terms of the baseball industry today, I think a lot of these pitchers do understand that this is probably more likely than not going to happen at some point in their career. And, you know, perhaps for Alex Reyes, if it goes well, surgery goes well, and if the rehab goes well, he can come back as good as ever.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen so many guys, you know, have the surgery and bounce back from it and be as good as ever. You know, a couple guys that come to mind, Matt Harvey from the Mets, the late Jose Fernandez, they both came back. They were both great, and no reason to think that Reyes won't be great too after he undergoes the rehab and gets back on a big league mound. Now, Jen, I'm curious that Reyes had experienced similar discomfort in that elbow back in 2013, but at that time he was able to work through it without going under the knife. Now, that said, Had there been something of a fear within the organization that maybe something like this might come up again in the future, or did the Cardinals think that, you know what, it's an isolated incident, he didn't need surgery, it's not something we have to worry about? What was the attitude about what he'd gone through 4 years ago?
Yeah, in talking with folks within the organization, it sounded like there was always that fear that something was coming. You know, the question was, is it going to come at age 22 or age 32? And there was really kind of an unknown there. I mean, Adam Wainwright went a decade pitching with a compromised ligament in his right elbow, and went a decade actually pitching quite well without being fully healthy. So while the Cardinals knew that there was the tear, and while, you know, Reyes was able to come back in 2013 with just some rest and rehab protocol, that tear was always going to be there. And now it's, of course, gotten to the point where it's essentially, as Mozeliak put it today, a ruptured ligament. But yeah, I mean, I think the Cardinals, again, expected this day to come. They just didn't know when it would be. And in talking to Alex Reyes, you know, to him, instead of kind of maybe being a deterioration of his ligament over time, he really believes that this was an instant just last week when he was throwing a bullpen session. He threw an off-speed pitch and felt sudden pain in his elbow. So it was certainly compromised for some time, and essentially was a matter of time before something went terribly wrong.
Yeah, and unfortunately that time is now, not 10 years from now, but, you know, maybe like you said moments ago, a blessing in disguise that they get this thing addressed, they get it fixed, and they get him back on the big league mound, you know, no later than age 23 or 24, and he can resume what was looking like a very promising career once he gets to that point. So, Jen, the million-dollar question now is, you know, if you assume that Reyes was going to hold down a fourth or fifth spot in that starting rotation, who becomes the guy to fill that void now?
Yeah, I mean, it's really going to come down to probably a competition of three with Michael Wacha, Luke Weaver, and Trevor Rosenthal, which is the kind of the interesting one of the group, competing for that fifth rotation spot. I do believe that Michael Wacha has the edge there. Of course, he's having to prove that he is healthy coming off a year in which he had shoulder issues again. He did just go through a winter program that was changed from recent off seasons past, and really focused a lot on strengthening the area around his shoulder so he wouldn't be compromised in ways that he had been, because let's not forget that this is a shoulder injury that has now occurred two of the last three seasons for him. So if Wacha can get through spring healthy, and I'll tell you, he looks really, really strong in a bullpen session earlier today, I think he has the inside track for that fifth starter spot. But the Cardinals are going to consider Luke Weaver, a kid who we saw come up last year and pitch okay in August and September, out of the rotation. And then the wild card is Trevor Rosenthal, their former closer, who they're going to stretch out this spring just to give some flexibility to maybe where Trevor can be used. I guess it's probably still an outside shot that Rosie ends up in the rotation come opening day, but he is certainly going to get a look.
Yeah, it seems that way. And, you know, assuming that, you know, maybe let's say the Cardinals opt for Wacha, what does Rosenthal's role become? You know, does he become a spot starter, an emergency starter, a guy that, you know, could set up for Son Juan Oh? I mean, what do you see his role being on this for this team after a very difficult 2016?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because I think it could be any of the above. You know, maybe in a perfect world, if Rosenthal has a dominant spring and he doesn't make the rotation, I could easily see him kind of working his way back into a setup spot and, you know, being a closer in waiting in case there's any issues with O. The other thing the Cardinals are intrigued by, and this really comes from what we saw in the postseason last October, is the possibility of having a really good reliever that can bridge games from a starter to the back end of the bullpen, maybe pitch two or three innings at a time. What we saw like with an Andrew Miller, even a Chapman at times in the postseason. Now, the Cardinals understand you can't replicate that over 162 games, but perhaps, you know, two to three outings a week of multiple innings is something that Trevor Rosenthal would be able to provide. So now really it's going to come down to what he shows in camp. One of the important things for him is going to be able to prove that he can use all three, four of his pitches, which he hasn't had to use as a closer. And also, you know, to see how he fares when he has to face the same lineup two or three times in order. So I think all that will be determined in recent weeks. But to me, he's certainly one of the most interesting cases in spring just because of all the places he could fit.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the thing that's fresh in our memories is how much he struggled in 2016. The thing you can't overlook, though, is how good he was before 2016. If we can see that Trevor Rosenthal here in 2017, what a boon that would be for the Cardinals, especially in light of this season-ending injury to Alex Reyes. And, Jen, backtracking just a little bit to Michael Wacha, he lost his arbitration case with the Cardinals. He's going to get about $500 million less than what he was gunning for. Now, John Mozeliak, the GM, said that, you know, this is strictly business and he didn't expect things to be, you know, awkward or weird between, you know, Waka and himself and the team and everything. But how do you think Waka feels? Because I got to think that so few players go into arbitration, you know, some win, some lose. Obviously, Waka came out on the losing side. Could that have any sort of effect, you know, in spring training or throughout the season? Or could it really be, you know, business as usual, as John Mozeliak put it?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen instances in the past where it has fractured a relationship between player and club. I mean, both sides right now are saying all the right things in terms of, you know, kind of what was said in the hearing room can stay in the hearing room. But the reality is that Michael Waka sat in the hearing room earlier this week and heard the Cardinals try to make their case as to why he doesn't deserve as much money as he thinks he does. So I think one of the things the Cardinals did that was very interesting is instead of having one of their front office members present the case, they actually hired outside counsel to present their arbitration case. And perhaps then, you know, by not hearing those words come from somebody within the organization, whether that's the GM or assistant GM, maybe it's not taken so personally. I did find it a little ironic, you know, the same day that we find out that Waka's losing his arbitration case is the same day that his presence on this team became that much more important with Reyes going down. So you hope that everybody can move forward. If anything, perhaps it can serve as added motivation for Michael Waka. And for the Cardinals, it was simply interesting in that they hadn't gone to an arbitration case since 1999.
Long time coming. 18 years. So Michael Waka losing his case, but like you said, the irony that this happens on the day that Reyes goes down for the season and he becomes as important a part of this team as he's ever been, and we'll see what 2017 brings for him. So, Jen, I want to wrap up on a bit of a lighthearted note. You know, the news about Reyes, the big news of the week, but number two in my mind was the announcement that Metallica is going to be at Busch Stadium on June 4th. Now, Billy Joel is also going to be performing at Busch Stadium. I can't quite recall the date, but if given the choice to attend one of the concerts, just one, Metallica or Billy Joel, you got both ends of the musical spectrum here, which concert would you be attending?
I would definitely attend the Billy Joel one first. And the problem, Matt, with all these concerts is, of course, they have to schedule them when the team is on the road, which means that I'm on the road, too. So odds are I won't be at either of them, but certainly if I had the option of one or the other, Billy Joel is the place that I would be.
I love the Piano Man, one of my favorites, but I got to go with my heavy metal roots and go to Metallica. So between the two of them, maybe we'll get both shows covered. And but like you said, it's a bummer for you that you're going to be on the road with the team when Busch Stadium is either rocking out or mellowing out. I'm not sure what you would say for Billy Joel, but either way, it's going to be two spectacular shows and a big summer planned ahead for Busch Stadium on both the baseball and musical fronts. That is for sure. Great place to wrap it up. Jen Langosch, we appreciate the time. We'll do it at this time again next week. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, St. Louis Cardinals. We're talking Pirates baseball today, this Thursday, the 16th of February, with Adam Berry, our Pirates reporter. Adam, thank you so much for the time. And Adam, I'm trying to ask all of the reporters for the NL Central teams to kind of give us a weather report now that you're out of the frigid Northeast. And I'm hoping that with you telling us of the warmth and sunshine of where you are right now, it's going to help warm us up a little bit, because I think it's in the 30s today and there's still snow. It's depressing. So have at it. Try to give us some warmth here through the microphone.
Yeah, I feel bad because I feel like that's just what we do on Twitter at the start of spring training, is just say, hey, the weather's nice down here. But well, since you asked for it, it is about 70 degrees. I'm on a little self-guided walking tour outside at Pirate City right now. Completely blue skies, sun is shining, the grass is green, everything looks pretty good down in this part of Bradenton, Florida.
Yeah, not too many complaints, I would think. So that's no. Good way to start things off. 70s beats 30s every time, unless you're golfing. So great stuff there. It's a good place to start. And Adam lets us start with talking about Juan Nicasio, and the Pirates have decided that this time he's going to remain in the bullpen, where he did finish off 2016 after kind of stumbling as a starter. But if you go back to 1 year ago, that was the plan then. And then he had this incredible spring training. The Pirates could not help but to put him in the rotation because he was so good. And, of course, we all saw how that worked out. Now, my question is, if he pitches lights out again, you know, albeit in relief roles, is there going to be any temptation to say, hey, you know what, let's try this again. Maybe we catch lightning in a bottle the second time. Or are they completely committed to keeping Nicasio in a place where they feel that he is the most comfortable?
Yeah, I think they're committed to keeping him in the bullpen and sort of, you know, that multi-inning sort of versatile role that he played down the stretch last season. And really, they've been committed to that all offseason. The question I kind of had coming into spring training was how Nicasio felt about it, because, you know, kind of like you alluded to there, he, you know, it seemed like he was sort of set for the bullpen last spring, and then he pitched so well, he kept talking about how he viewed himself as a starter. So I talked to him about it, and he, you know, he said, no more starting for me. He said, you know, you want to be where you're the best, and he's better off in the bullpen. You know, he could see himself sort of eventually developing into kind of a late inning, you know, one inning type of guy, but he's, you know, willing to take the ball as often as he's asked to. It was surprising to hear from him because he finished really high up on the team leaderboard in both appearances and innings, just kind of a testament to how often and how hard he worked, that his arm felt good at the end of the season. But he did more sort of endurance work over the winter, kind of focused on, you know, being available and staying strong through the course of the season like a reliever might need to. But, yeah, he seems pretty comfortable with that, kind of come to that conclusion that it's the best for his career right now, and it's certainly best for the team as they head into this season.
Yeah, that certainly seems to be the consensus there. And, you know, Adam, do you get the sense in talking to him and maybe some other guys in a similar predicament that, you know, maybe – whereas at one time there was, you know, much more pride in being a starting pitcher than quote-unquote just a reliever. But now, given the emphasis on relief pitching and how important bullpens are to a team's success, is that stigma kind of gone, or is it at least starting to go away, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the difference is still, you know, in terms of what you get paid, your salary, you know, the best starters still get paid more than the best relievers, but I think the overall importance of relievers is just so much greater now, especially coming off of the postseason that we had last year. You know, everybody kind of realizes that you need not only seven relievers, you need seven good relievers. You probably need something more along the lines of like 12 to 15 relievers to, you know, to get through a full season. And, you know, the best teams have the best bullpens typically. So I think, you know, these guys especially here get it. But I think it's probably more the case just across the game that, you know, yeah, like you can carve out a really nice long career for yourself out of the bullpen.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully that's the path that Nicasio remains on here in 2017. It could be a very important part of that revamped Pirates bullpen. Going offensively now, Adam, Josh Bell underwent surgery on the first of the month to remove a loose body from his left knee. I still kind of chuckle when I hear loose bodies, but whatever. Kind of give us an update on him, and is he on the projected timetable to get back onto the field? Has it been sped up or slowed down, or where does that stand right now?
No, it seems like he's pretty well on track. You know, he's been doing baseball activities. I think I saw him hitting in the cage off a tee today. That would be a pretty big step. You know, he's been doing some cardio work. He's throwing. You know, everyone from Neil Huntington to the head athletic trainer, Todd Thompson, have really just lauded the way that he kept himself in shape throughout the offseason, so it shouldn't be too big of a leap once he is ready to kind of catch up with his teammates. The first full squad workout is tomorrow as we're speaking. That's Friday. So, you know, he's probably not going to be running through everything with his teammates, taking batting practice and stuff like that, probably not doing a lot of work at first base. But, yeah, he's recovering well. He seems really optimistic. He said the other day that opening day is not really even a question in his mind, which is certainly what you want to hear after the Pirates released a statement saying that his status for that was to be determined. But, yeah, you know, he's not ready to be on the field 2 weeks out from surgery, but you could certainly see where the optimistic side of that time frame is now become realistic.
Yeah, no question. A young guy, a big, strong guy, and somebody that you want to see on the field for the entirety of the season. It's going to be exciting to see what he can do over the course of his first full big league campaign. Adam, let's go to the outfield now. Andrew McCutchen and Gregory Polanco. Let's start with McCutchen. Is began the year last year hitting number two and playing center field. 12 months later, he's going to be batting third and playing right field. So some wholesale changes here for the former MVP. Now, the numbers suggest that these are the right moves to make. As far as McCutchen's attitude is, I would think that knowing what we know about him and being a team-first guy, that he's got to be on board with this, correct?
Yeah, I mean, he was on board with the whole switch to the number two spot last year. That seemed kind of like a radical change at the time. Little did we know he'd be in right field a year later. That would seem like a much more significant change. But he was comfortable in the number three spot last year. I'm not of the opinion that the batting order spot matters that much. You know, it was just he was in a slump while he was batting second last year. and he broke out of that slump while he was batting third last year, but it did not seem related to the spot in the order. It was more just mechanics and mindset and stuff like that. We have not actually spoken to Andrew yet. He checked into camp earlier this week, and you know he pushed his physical back to Friday morning before the first full squad workout, so hopefully we'll get a chance to pick his brain. He's going to be one of the most watch spring training stories, you know, throughout baseball. So hopefully we'll get to talk to him Friday. But Clint Hurdle, speaking for him, you know, and the conversations that they've had, said Andrew has bought into everything, basically. You know, he's ready to go to right field if that's what's best for the team. He still thinks he can play center field, and he might still play some center field when Starling Marte is off or, you know, injured or something like that. So you probably haven't seen Andrew McCutchen play his last inning in center field. But I think you're probably going to see him in the number three spot for the duration of this season, despite the logic and the data behind the move to the second hole last year.
Yeah, I mean, it made sense from that regard, you know, batting him second, getting him more ABs throughout the course of a season. But, again, the numbers, you know, just weren't there. And like you said, he did have better numbers batting third, even though you can't really attribute that to just dropping one spot in the order. Like you said, more mindset and mechanics. But look, at the end of the day, if he's more comfortable batting third, keep him batting third. It's, you know, it's a pretty simple thing. That's what they're going to do, and hopefully success will follow Mr. McCutchen going forward. Now, one guy that you have spoken to is Gregory Polanco. His splits last year between pre- and post-All-Star break, rather drastic. The last 2 months of the year, a struggle for him. So what has he done, or what is he doing to ensure that he does not kind of fall off a cliff this year and he can put together, you know, 6 solid months on the year?
Yeah, we talked to Gregory Polanco and Starling Marte today, mostly about the outfield changes, but also, you know, we had to ask Polanco about, you know, the slump that he had to end the season, what changed. You know, Clint Hurdle has basically said that, you know, he may have gotten tired, he may have been, you know, struggled to adjust to the way that the league kind of punched back at him once they saw the really good success that he had the first half of last year. Like you mentioned, those numbers were, a middle-of-the-lineup hitter, a potential star in the making there. So Polanco, he noticed that as well. He said that he just kind of got tired at the end of last season. So, you know, he started his off-season routine after he let his body heal. He had a couple of minor nagging injuries down the stretch last year, so he rested for October. And then he said he got back after in November and worked harder than he ever has. That's kind of a cliche this time of year, but you get the sense that it was true, is the way that Polanco was talking about it today. So, you know, he really wanted to put his body in shape to, you know, not just get through the summer, but to get through September, October, and even mentioned into November, because, you know, this is a guy who wants to play in the World Series. I think that in and of itself was a really interesting comment, because you think of Polanco as this young guy, but, you know, now he's got a contract extension, he's got some security, he's established himself in the big leagues. I think this is kind of a guy who's, you know, maybe not a leader in the traditional sense, but, you know, he's moved on to that next stage of his career where, you know, he's playing to win. He's playing to win as a team. He wants to be a part of a championship club. And I think he realizes that he can be a really big part of their success. You know, if they're going to have a good year, he probably needs to kind of step into that third outfield star role that we really saw him kind of, you know, take strides toward early last season. So, you know, he's done all the right things and said all the right things so far. Just very curious to see how he holds up over the course of a long season.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, and like you said, it sounds cliche when guys say, you know, they worked harder than they ever have before. They're in the best shape that they have ever been in. But, you know, when you look at it nowadays, there's so much emphasis and importance on what a guy does in the off season. That's where the battles are really won or lost if you don't put in the work during those long winter months, because the season is such a grind. So many demands placed on you physically and mentally. You've got to get your body and your head straight during those winter months to get ready, you know, for the 162 game and perhaps beyond grind. And that's what Gregory Polanco's done. And we'll see if the numbers follow suit here in 2017. Adam, to begin to wrap up here, as you've been with the team now for a couple of days, give me some things that have kind of stood out to you, caught your eye, caught your ear. If somebody made a comments that really stood out, I don't know, just your observations from being down there as the guys are all back together for the first time since early October.
Yeah, I think the first thing is that Gerrit Cole says he's right on track. He's throwing bullpens from the start with his usual group. That's obviously a step in the right direction after he came to spring training a little bit behind, rehabbing from a rib injury last year. So that's, you know, sort of the big piece of important news for the rotation. Ivan Nova seems so comfortable. It's incredible to see how, you know, how comfortable he really is in his first spring training with the Pirates. That was part of what led him back here to Pittsburgh when he signed in the offseason for what many people consider to be a lower value deal. He even mentioned that, you know, you can make money or you can be happy, and he chose to be happy, you know, while still making plenty of money, to be fair. But the other thing I think that stands out is the comfort of the young guys. You know, it's funny, last spring we were looking around at guys like Jameson Taillon, Tyler Glasnow, Stephen Brault, Chad Kuhl, you know, some of those young arms, Josh Bell, the young hitters, Adam Frazier. And, you know, they were still rookies. They were young guys. They were coming in. You know, they were, you know, deferring to the veterans and things like that. But now you come in and you see, you know, they're part of the nucleus right now. They are a very important part of this club. They seem comfortable. They seem confident in where they are. You know, I think a lot has to go right for the Pirates this season. Most of it's through the young guys. But, you know, you realize that these are guys with pretty high ceilings. They have a lot of potential, and they certainly believe in themselves. And, you know, the Pirates believe in them as well. So it's been really kind of neat to see this sort of young core step forward, even in the first days of spring training, just with, you know, the way that they kind of own the room, the way that they interact with each other, the way they go about their work, and these kind of early workouts. So that's really stood out to me, I think, just being around the clubhouse for many hours in the morning and afternoon, as we do here in spring training. But it's been kind of neat to see, I think, and hopefully fans can kind of appreciate that as they kind of watch these guys grow up in front of them.
Yeah, it's amazing how much can change in 1 year. You know, you'd see these guys go from, you know, wide-eyed kids to all of a sudden leaders on the team and the nucleus of the team and emerging leaders in the clubhouse. It really is remarkable, and that seems to be the transformation taking place with the Pirates right now as they hope for big things here in 2017. Mr. Berry, great stuff as always. We'll do it again at this time next week. In the meantime, it's Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Pittsburgh Pirates. It is Thursday, the 16th of February, and we're talking at Brewers baseball today with Adam McKelvey, our Brewers reporter. And, Adam, I want to start off by having you give us a weather report as you were with the team in spring training and you were out of the cold confines of Wisconsin. And for my benefit, too, because for some reason they have shut down the heat going into the voiceover booths here at MLB.com. So today it's more of a voiceover igloo. So I'm a little chilly, and I'm hoping if you can give us a warm weather report, it will get the blood back to my extremity. So go ahead.
Yeah, well, look, I landed here the day before pitchers and catchers reported to Brewers camp, got my car, got in my hotel, dropped my bags, and went straight to Piestewa Peak here in Phoenix to do a good hike. It was a great climb, and I got to the top and looked at the weather, and it was 72 degrees and sunny. So that's pretty much copy and paste for Phoenix at this time of year. It's pretty spectacular.
Yeah, well, I'm a little warmer and a lot jealous. So hats off to you for that experience as you're getting to work, of course, with the club in Arizona as we lay out the foundation for what the Brewers are hoping will be a successful 2017 season. Before we talk about current Brewers, want to talk about a now former Brewer, something we did not get to last week, but old friend Chris Carter, now a Yankee. How shocking was that to you?
Well, I didn't see the Yankees coming. I'll tell you, I sensed a little bit of relief in the Brewers front offices that he was able to find a job. Remember, he had floated, or rather his representative, Dave Stewart, had floated the idea of maybe going, playing overseas, just because he couldn't get a big league offer that piqued his interest in Major League Baseball. That would have been a real shame for a guy who did everything he was asked of last year, hit 41 home runs, tied Nolan Arenado for the NL lead. To not be able to find a gig would have been very disappointing. And I think that people were, I don't, maybe relieved is not the right word, but they were certainly happy in those Brewers front offices that a good guy, Chris Carter, who did a good job, was able to find a job and remain in Major League Baseball. And now we'll see what happens there, because there are playing time issues there with the Yankees. And, man, would it be a shame for Carter to go out again, do whatever he's asked, and then find himself in the same position for the third straight year. I personally hope that doesn't happen, but he's got a battle on his hands.
Yeah, he sure does, and it's a very intriguing fits, you know, Carter in that ballpark. We've seen what he can do. He's got power, obviously, but especially opposite field power, the short porch in right field in the Bronx, which is, what, I don't know, 150 feet from home plate or so,
yeah.
It seems. So he can really feast on that if he gets enough playing time and sees enough pitches to hit. It could be something very interesting to keep an eye on for 2017. But like you said, I think a lot of people, knowing the kind of guy he is, rooting for him to get a big league job, He's got it, and we hope that he makes the most of it here. So getting back to the guys that remain in Brewers uniforms, your first couple of days there in camp, give me a couple things that have kind of stood out to you, things that have caught your eye, caught your ear as the guys all come back together for a brand-new season.
Well, look, it's what strikes me is that not a lot of things are striking me. In other words, when we came to camp last season, it was Craig Counsell's first spring training in charge as manager because he hadn't taken over till May in 2015. It was David Stearns and Matt Arnold first year as GM and assistant GM, kind of in charge of the operation. There were some new faces on the coaching staff, including Pat Murphy, Craig Counsell's old college coach. That made a big difference. There was a new pitching coach in Derek Johnson. There were a lot of changes last season as camp began, and the get-to-know-you that happens every year in every clubhouse around baseball was happening in the front office here in Milwaukee as well. That now is over. They're going into year two with this regime, and I think what strikes me is just it's a very – so far it's only a couple of days. Just not a lot of big news, kind of just going about the business. Bullpens are happening each day. There's a high number of – or high percentage of the position players are already here, which is no surprise considering the youth that they have throughout the team. It's kind of just ho-hum here so far, and I know Craig Counsell well enough to know that he would love for this entire camp to go as smoothly and quietly as these first couple of days have gone. So that sort of stands out to me. Now, there are questions here for this club. They've got a catcher situation to figure out as they sort of turn the page from the Lucroy-Maldonado era. They've got some decisions to make in their starting rotation. So there's going to be news in this camp, but just in terms of the very big picture, it's sort of business as usual.
And like you said, I think that's how Craig Counsell prefers it. Certainly the guys that are in charge, you don't want, turmoil is not the right word, but, you can do without, excitement every single day. You just want to, get down to business and do what you do and focus on the little things. And so far, that's kind of what the theme has been from the sounds of it in Brewers camp here in the early going. Now, to focus on one guy in particular, a guy that we tend to focus on a lot, one of our favorites, Willie Peralta. Now, of course, we know the story on him. He struggled big time in 2016, but came on very strong at the end. Final 10 starts, a sub-3 ERA. That was the pitcher the Brewers thought they were going to see at the onset of 2016. Didn't quite happen. Now, what's worth noting that he is going to play for this loaded Dominican Republic team, the defending champions in the upcoming World Baseball Classic. Now, that's obviously going to take him away from Brewers camp and away from those rotation battles for which he does not yet have a spot locked down. He's not a Guerra. He's not a Davies in that regard. So your take on this, leaving camp for however long he's gone, whether it's a couple of weeks, how much, if any, could that hurt his chances of cracking this rotation?
Well, first of all, isn't it amazing that we're talking about last year's opening day starter for the Brewers, and now we're talking about the fact that he doesn't have a job locked down. That does not happen every day. Actually, the new rules of the World Baseball Classic are probably a good thing for Willie Peralta. He is in this designated pitcher pool, so he's only going to be part of the Dominican Republic team for the first round of this tournament. So he'll go to Florida in early March. I believe he said they'll play a couple of exhibition games against the Orioles and then the first round of the tournament in Miami. And then he'll come back to Brewers camp, even if, as I think a lot of people expect, the Dominican Republic moves on. That's a good thing. So he'll miss a week. He'll miss one spring training start. And from the point of view of battling for a job, that's not going to impact one way or the other his ability to do that. I think it's a good thing versus, as you said, being away from camp for a big chunk of this. That could be a little more problematic, and I think Peralta probably would have had to have a decision to make there. But in this case, he's able to say he participated, he watched them win this thing the last time there was a World Baseball Classic, and the opportunity to take part in it, you can imagine, is pretty special to this guy. And he gets to do it without impacting his day job, basically. So I think this is one of those cases where the new rules are a good thing for this particular player.
Yeah, it's a great point that he's in that, as you said, the designated pitcher pool. He's only going to miss, a week tops from the sounds of it. So he gets, best of both worlds. He gets to represent his country, play for a great team, and not miss too much time. as he looks to lock down a spot in that rotation. And like you said, you know, a great point, last year's opening day starter, now fighting to be one of the five in Milwaukee's rotation here in 2017. And as far as other roster battles, you touched on this a little bit. Is that catcher battle the most intriguing one right now in your eyes? And if so, I know that we talked a couple of weeks ago about the possibility of Matt Wieters. That's kind of simmered down a little bit. Have you heard anything more along those lines?
No, I haven't. And I think what they're saying here is they like the guys they've got. The Wieters thing is interesting because he's a Scott Boras player, and we've seen Boras clients show up here in Brewers camp late in spring training before Kyle Loesch being the leader. So there's a conduit there between the agent and the owner of this ball club that has worked out before. So I guess the way to look at it is, until Matt Wieters signs somewhere else, the Brewers are still technically in play. But I'll tell you, they like these three guys they've got. They traded for all of them: Jet Bandy, Andrew Susak, and Manny Pena, not household names by any stretch. But Bandy is a really interesting guy. He looks like a third baseman, and I talked to him. He did play third base in high school. He's a longer than most catchers, 6'5", and a good all-around player. The Brewers think he has power that hasn't manifested itself in his minor league statistics, but you see off the bat, he's got a good chance here, I think, coming into camp. And then we'll see what happens at those other two spots. What I loved talking to the guys about over the last couple of days, and I just did a story about this, is, you know, basically you come into a new team, a new organization, all of those guys have over the last year or so, and you look around and you have to learn all these new pitchers and gain their trust and gain the trust of the coaches and learn the organization and how they do things all kind of at once. And it seems a daunting task to me. And I talked to each of those guys about how they go about it. And what was really intriguing to me is I kind of got three different answers of where do you start, whether it's just asking them about, as Jet Bandy kind of goes to the X's and O's, what do you throw? What do you like to do? Andrew Susak was more interested in getting to know the guy's personalities first and let the X's and O's come later. He says that's how Buster Posey taught him to do it in San Francisco. And Manny Pena actually likes to see what the guy can do first before he starts talking to him about what he thinks he can do. And it struck me as kind of an interesting example that there's a lot of different ways to go about being a good catcher in this game, and these guys all kind of think about it in a different way.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because you would think that guys who are cut from the same cloth as far as a position would have the same sorts of theories about the best way to go about your job. That's not always the case, especially at the catcher position, as you just illustrated there. And Adam, I think another question we have to ask here is Jet Bandy the coolest name in baseball? And for me, it's a top five.
It's pretty good. The Brewers have a hard-throwing reliever named Damian Magnifico,
Wow. Which
is pretty darn good. For some reason, they had a farmhand. Now, I believe he's retired from baseball. His name is Tommy Toledo. To me, that's like the best baseball name I've ever heard. He was one of my favorite guys. But Jet Bandy's pretty good, and there's a story behind it, which everyone is going to have to Google, because I forget. It's a combination of his grandfather's name and something else, which we'll edit that in later, or everyone can just go Google it.
I like that. And I remember when he was with the Angels, I came across that story, and like you, I don't quite recall the details, but it is some hybrid of some
pros,
family members'
man.
Names. But there is an interesting backstory to that name. And you
which
know, like,
neither of us know.
Right,
do they charge for these podcasts? Yeah,
I
really
hope not.
Ought to start charging for
I hope not. We're trying to piece together what little information we can retain. But like you said, Google is everybody's friend. So go out there, Google it, Jet Bandy with two T's, and you will have your answer.
We do know how to spell it.
That's true. That's something. It's a good starting point. We know there's two T's in Jet. So for the guys out there and ladies listening, yeah, it's a good story. It's out there somewhere. We just don't have it in our heads right now. So, Adam, something we do have in our heads, a story that you have, which was very cool on Brewers.com regarding Hank Aaron's final two seasons in the major leagues, of course, back in Milwaukee, where it all began with the once Milwaukee Braves. Of course, the Brewers at that time, a very young franchise. And I didn't know until reading the article that for a brief time, Hank Aaron and Robin Yount were teammates, which kind of blew me away. That was something. You interviewed a lot of great guys, including Robin Yount, Bob Uecker, too, about Hammer and Hank's last 2 years in Milwaukee. So just kind of walk us through that experience and how great it was for you to kind of put that feature together.
Well, first of all, it's Hank Aaron. So anytime you write about him, it's great. Sort of as good a man as he was a ball player. And I've been fortunate enough to meet him a couple of times and shake that gigantic mitt he's got. It's pretty awesome. I made Robin Yount laugh because I asked him to sort of recall what was the buzz when Hank Aaron signed with the team. Remember, this was a Brewers franchise. It was only 5 years old at the time.
Right.
And he looked at me kind of like, what are you talking about? It's Hank Aaron, the home run king. What was the buzz? So for him, he said the hardest part was just trying to figure out how to introduce himself to this guy. He brought in such gravitas to the clubhouse, really then, you know, fit right in right away and kind of was one of the guys. Now, he was not the same player at that stage of his career. He was into his 40s. You know, he was not the five-tool talent he was when he was with the Milwaukee Braves and winning the World Series in 1957 for the fans at County Stadium. I think everybody understood that. But he also did bring something to some of those young players, Robin Yount being one of them, playing two seasons alongside Hank Aaron, and was so warmly welcomed by the fans. That's one of the really interesting things is to hear Hank Aaron talk about his time in Milwaukee and really in Wisconsin, because his pro career began in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which if you think about Wisconsin looking like a mitten, it's kind of near the up close to the pinky finger. That's where he really got his start in pro ball. And he said he was always treated extremely warmly by the fans in Wisconsin. They never booed him, even when, you know, I think there was an understanding that he wasn't going to hit 40 home runs anymore as a 40-something. But he still did, you know, draw cheers and draw crowds to County Stadium. And there was a big buzz when Hank Aaron came back to the Brewers. Kind of a way for his career to come full circle. And it seemed like a good time as we were doing a series of stories kind of celebrating Black History Month to revisit those 2 years and the return of Hank Aaron to the Brewers.
Yeah, I mean, and what a great way to celebrate Black history by talking about a guy who was so revolutionary and a guy that many still consider the all-time home run king, 755. And, man, what a great story. What a great man. He just turned 83 a couple of weeks ago, and he is still going strong. That is certainly great to hear and great to see, and a great place to wrap this one up here on this Thursday. Adam McKelvey, our thanks to you as always. Enjoy the hiking, the sunshine, the baseball, and everything else down there in Arizona, and we'll do it again next week. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Milwaukee Brewers. It is Wednesday, the 15th of February, and spring training is in full gear as we are talking Reds baseball today with Mark Sheldon, our Reds reporter. Mark, thank you as always for the time. And, of course, the big news of the week this past weekend, actually, the news that Brandon Phillips is now an ex-Red as he is sent to the Braves in his home states of Georgia to play for his hometown team, and a pair of minor league pitchers coming to Cincinnati in that deal. And, Mark, is this something you saw coming at least a little bit, or did this trade kind of knock you sideways a little bit?
Well, I think it knocked a lot of people sideways in the sense it just came together very quickly. As you may remember, there was a trade in the works that we learned about in January, but back in November, the Reds had an opportunity to trade Phillips to the Braves, and Phillips uses his no trade rights to block the trade, and GM Dick Williams had kind of given up on the idea, and they were preparing for Phillips to come to camp and have four middle infielders trying to make that work. And when the Braves found out late last week that Sean Rodriguez, who they signed after Phillips turned them down, was going to be out 3 to 5 months for shoulder surgery from his car accident, the Braves placed another call to the Reds, and this time Phillips was more open to waiving his no trade, and the deal came together pretty quickly. Reds didn't really have a lot of leverage. They picked up $13 of the $14 million in Phillips' salary, and they got two minor leaguers that are not considered prospects in any way, shape, or form. They're not going to be in big league camp. So, things kind of came together quick. And literally on the first day I got here, I landed, and I drove straight to the Reds complex for a media session with Dick Williams. So it was an interesting way to start camp for sure.
Yeah, I'll say. And like you said, this thing came together so fast, it kind of caught everybody off guard. And now you never like to hear about, you know, anybody having the sort of a misfortune that Sean Rodriguez did. As you said, he's going to be out between 3 and 5 months due to a car accident. But if you're Brandon Phillips and, you catch wind of this and then you know that trade talks are being revisited, in his mind, did he kind of say, you know, well, maybe I'm more open to a trade now because I am going to get some playing time with this guy hurt. Is that kind of what triggered this whole thing?
No, I think it is more, and I can't speak for him because I have not spoken to him yet, but I got the impression is that just during the off season in general, since November, there was Reds Fest, was in December, they had the winter meetings as well, that I think the Reds had a pretty frank conversation with him that kind of let him know his playing time was not going to be the same as it had been in the past. He's always been a guy that's played 150 games or so, and they wanted Jose Peraza to play more. Whether it be a second base or shortstop or in left or center field, but primarily in that middle infield. And they also eventually want to make room for Dilson Herrera and see what he has. Phillips obviously wasn't going to be back after 2017, no matter what. And they really all wanted to find out what they had in Peraza and Herrera. So I think that may have greased the wheels a little bit, so to speak, and helped make move that deal along. I don't know if how much he cared about going home to Atlanta or not, but I think he realized that his opportunities were going to be drying up a little bit in Cincinnati, and I think it was just time to move on. I think the only other options Reds would have had, honestly, is if they really wanted to get Peraz involved, they would have had to release him. And you didn't want him to come to camp and have an uncomfortable situation, and I think this ended up working well for both sides. The Reds got rid of Phillips. They didn't lose the salary yet, obviously, because they eat so much of it, but now Jose Peraz is the everyday second baseman, and Dilson Herrera is going to have a chance to make the team. Zach Cozart is still the shortstop, and until further notice, and we'll see what they have.
Yeah, it's funny how things have a way of working out sometimes with this whole transaction where Phillips is now a member of the Atlanta Braves, and of course that is the obvious other half of this equation. With Phillips gone, it really opens up playing time for Peraza and for Dilson Herrera, like you mentioned. And if you had to pick, I guess, one word to describe the feeling in the organization now that this is a done deal and Phillips is no longer, you know, blocking the younger guys, would that word be relief? Is that kind of the best way to describe how the Reds feel about this whole thing right now?
I think it's somewhat relieving. I mean, Brian Price had a conundrum on his hands to try to figure out how is he going to get enough playing time in spring and then even in the season to figure out how Cozart and Phillips, two guys who have earned the right to play every day, could make way for two younger guys. And you know, Brian was pretty adamant that Jose Peraza to him was a regular player, that he had showed enough of what he could do in the 70-plus games he played last season while hitting .324, that he merited everyday playing time somehow. And for Brian, that was a conundrum, to say the least. So this way, it does kind of free things up. Now Peraza is penciled in as the everyday second baseman, and Herrera is going to have to try to take the Peraza role of playing maybe multiple times a week at different positions. And the one problem for him is that he's only a second baseman, so he's going to have to really bone up on third base and other spots to see if he have a chance to make the team, because otherwise they may have to have him be a Triple-A to play every day.
And, of course, you know, I think this is one of those classic trades where it's addition by subtraction in the classic sense. But nonetheless, you know, we are talking about a guy in Brandon Phillips who does have a proven track record. The guy did hit in the 290s last year. He still is versatile and valuable. So given all that, is there still a little bit of disappointment that the two guys that got in return, as you said at the top of the podcast, are by no means highly touted prospects? You know, could the Reds or should the Reds have gotten back a little bit more for a guy that, again, does have a proven track record?
No, I mean, not at all. They're lucky they got anything, honestly. I mean, you have to really, if you really look at it, he's going to be 36 years old in a couple months. He had the no trade thing going. The salary was a big handcuff. You know, I know you said he hit .290s, but a lot of his other numbers really weren't that flashy. He's been, you know, having diminishing returns both offensively and defensively. His speed isn't what it once was. You could thank him for the years he had, but that doesn't mean that the players that are going to come back should warrant, you know, the kind of prime of his career. It's warranting where he is now. And when you're having a divorce like this, sometimes you don't worry about the assets and what you're splitting up. You just want it to be over and you move on. And I think they decided, let's move on. And for him, he got a soft landing. I think this worked out better for him than he could have imagined. He could have, like I said, been released. And then that would have been just not as good of a way to go out after an 11-year career. He's going to be a Reds Hall of Famer for sure, but you don't want to see his career with the Reds end that way. And now he's got a trade. He's got a chance to prove himself in Atlanta and play in a new stadium and see what happens.
Yeah, good point. This worked out great for everybody involved. Like you said, the outcome of this for Phillips personally could have been a lot worse than him landing with an up-and-coming Atlanta club. He can provide some veteran presence and leadership, and the Reds' infield situation really sorts itself out well. And, Mark, in reading, you know, your coverage of the trade and talking about Phillips himself, I get the feeling that, and this is not a newsflash by any means, that he's one of the more complex players you've ever covered. It seems like on one hand, very beloved by the fans. He's a guy that interacts on social media, a guy that will sign autographs till his hand gets tired. On the other hand, he's had some incidents in the clubhouse with some teammates. So, again, going back to the original point, of all the guys that you've covered in all the years covering this Reds team, would he be right at the top of the list or near the top in terms of one of the more complex players you've seen?
Yeah, certainly. He's definitely in that list. I don't know if we've talked about this in the past or not, but over the last few years especially, there's been instances where he wasn't speaking to me or speaking to members of the media at all. I think Phillips and I went through a two-year stretch where I did not interview him one time. He wouldn't talk to me. I know he did that with other writers as well. And, you know, there was a time when he signed a six-year, $72 million contract in 2012. He went to a magazine and said it was a slap to the face, which is a very odd, you know, comment for that kind of contract, because he didn't like it that Joey Votto got his mega contract done first and he had to wait for Votto's, and then he got his, and he found that to be disrespectful for whatever reason. He also got into it with one of my colleagues. It was caught on camera. He's screaming and, you know, being verbally abusive, and in Dusty Baker's office, it was all caught on camera, and it was a very, very ugly scene. And those are the kind of things that kind of detract from some of the things that he did that were positive. He had a very positive run with, like what they said, with the fans, and he had a flashy style that was definitely popular and got him on the highlight reels all the time, and you know, certainly national television loved him. But yeah, definitely some mixed stuff there that didn't go so well for him. But I think overall his Reds career was a success. He came in over in 2006 in April after opening day as a designated for assignment player from the Indians, who ran out of chances up there. And Wayne Krivsky traded for him for a guy named Jeff Stevens, a minor leaguer, and it was a fantastic trade for the Reds, no matter what you say.
Yeah, no question. And Mark, if you don't mind me asking, what was his issue with you in particular? Was it just you were part of a overall media boycott, or was there something in particular with you where you went the 2 years without speaking?
I think it was a little bit of both. I don't remember the exact story, but I had written a story that he did not care for, and he stopped talking. And honestly, it's funny, I don't even remember the story anymore. But there was something that didn't really go his way. There was another set time in 2010, I think, when we weren't really simpatico either. So it comes and it goes, you know. Like this past year, I will say this, we didn't really speak at all, I think, during 2014 and 2015. But last season, when I did try to interview him, he was very cordial, and he was professional, and he did the interviews. And then the last time I interviewed him was at the winter meetings this past year. And, you know, I have to say he was very nice. He wasn't truthful about it. He was asked whether he had talked about the trade stuff, and it turned out that there was a trade attempt in November that he decided not to mention, or he, you know, didn't say, he said nothing was going on. So, but other than that, it was a very good conversation, and so I wish him well.
Yeah, as I'm sure most Reds fans do, he's now a member of the Atlanta Braves, and life goes on, as they say. And Mark, in the final minute or two that we have here, just give us your thoughts on Homer Bailey. That was the other big news before the Phillips trade. Another setback for him, and where does this put him? What does this do to the Reds' rotation?
Yeah, it's definitely a big blow to lose Homer Bailey. Even though he was coming off Tommy John surgery, they were counting on his veteran presence and to provide a good chunk of innings, and now they're going to have to replace. It's going to be a young staff already. They only have really three starters they can count on. This now leaves two rotation spots open at the back end, and you're going to see young guys like Cody Reed, Robert Stevenson, Amir Garrett, plus Tim Adelman. They just got a guy, Bonilla, from the Pirates off a waiver, who's going to be in the mix for the competition. And, of course, Bronson Arroyo is here as a non-roster player, and he's going to be in the battle for that spot as well. But without Homer Bailey available now until at least the beginning of June, he's already on the 60-day disabled list. There are going to be some thin for enough guys that can pick up those innings. You can't assume that any of those prospects can fill that void. You have to see them do it on the mound, but that's what they're hoping to do. I don't think they're going to pick up another pitcher. And they're going to have to wait for Homer Bailey to come back from now his third elbow surgery.
Yeah, very interesting week for the Reds, to say the very least. Mark Sheldon, we appreciate the time as always, and we'll do it again soon. In the meantime, it's Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Cincinnati Reds. We're talking Cubs baseball today on this Wednesday, the 15th of February. It is Matt Wehmeyer joined by Cubs reporter Kerry Muscat, as Kerry is on the scene at Cubs spring training. And Kerry, the big news of the past couple days regarding Kyle Schwarber, he was examined by the Cubs medical staff on Tuesday, and if he was medically cleared, then the Cubs would allow him to get at least a couple days a week behind the plate with catching activities. So just kind of update us on that, how the examination went, and if it's all systems go right now.
Yeah, Kyle was examined on Tuesday, and we're talking on Wednesday, and we got word this morning that he's been okayed to start up with the catchers. What that means doesn't mean he's going to be catching 6 days a week. What it means is that 1 or 2 days a week he's going to be doing some catching drills. He'll probably be out there every morning. The catchers are usually the first ones on the field doing some workout stuff. And the other thing is they can have Schwarber involved in catching drills where he doesn't necessarily have to be squatting down and putting strain on the left knee. So he'll be involved with them. I think the nice thing for Kyle is that he came into camp thinking that he was going to be limited to left field, and now he knows that he'll be allowed to catch a little bit, and that's something that he'd like to resume doing. In the future, the nice thing is easing him into this. He could be catching, you know, a little more regularly in 2018, 2019, but as of right now, he's primarily a left fielder, and he'll be considered during the season as sort of the third catcher, the emergency guy.
And Kerry, I'm curious as to how this whole thing came about. Was it his idea? Did he go up to, you know, management and say, you know, hey, look, I would still like to catch. I still very much have an interest in catching. Or was it the team that kind of came to him and said, you know, what would you think about, you know, resuming activities, if possible, to become a third catcher for this team? How did that kind of come about?
Well, not exactly. I don't think it's been – Kyle has made it any secret that he wants to catch again. That's never been a question. It's just really a matter of what his knee can handle. So it's not a matter of, you know, anybody saying yay or nay. It's just, you know, all players go through physicals when they get down here to Mesa, and it was just a matter of let's see what your knee can do. Let's see what we can allow you to do and go from there. I mean, Kyle's made it clear even right after he had the injury that he still wants to catch. So that's his goal. And I'm pretty sure that Cubs fans will see him in catcher's gear at some point.
Yeah, definitely. Behind Wilson Contreras and Miguel Montero, that's not a bad option C to have in the form of Kyle Schwarber behind the plate. And, Kerry, you mentioned briefly the brace that he's wearing on his left knee. Is how much of an adjustment is that for him? It seems like from the articles you've written that, you know, he's saying the right things and that he accepts that he's going to have to wear this thing possibly throughout the duration of his career. So how is that adjustment going for him? I know that for some players it can be quite cumbersome, but what about for him?
No, it's not cumbersome at all. He said it's just like another body part.
And that's how he's going to treat it, and that's what he will do going forward. So all systems go for Kyle Schwarber, as a couple days a week we should see him behind the plate getting some time. And other than that, he projects to be the starting left fielder for the Cubs when opening day arrives. And, Kerry, I just want to get your opinion on kind of the feel of camp as the Cubs open things up on Tuesday, like you said, in Mesa, as defending World Series champions for the first time since 1909. We're going to be hearing a lot of that throughout the season. So just give me a few observations, things that caught your eye, caught your ear, as, you know, this Cubs team that had all these expectations at this time last year, you know, now kind of triumphantly walk onto the field as the team that everybody else is chasing.
It really isn't any different than last year, to be perfectly honest. I hate to crush your buildup here, but it's nothing has changed. They now have 40 pitchers in camp, which seems like a lot. Even Joe Maddon mentioned that it was a little crowded out there, but their same attitude, same approach, which I think is the best thing for the Cubs right now, is to just keep the same hunger and the same, you know, same focus. You know, they want to do it again. They enjoyed the whole winning last year, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah, and speaking of Joe Maddon, it seems like, you know, we talked at length last year about, you know, some of the phrases and catchy buzzwords he had. You know, there was embrace the target. There was try not to severely stink, if you will, if there's some young ears out there in the audience. And, of course, what we're hearing and reading so far is that he, you know, he wants his players to be uncomfortable. He's talked about authenticity. And then my personal favorite so far, he's talked about don't forget the heartbeat. So I want you to kind of elaborate on each of those and what the theme is and what the message is behind those words and those phrases from Joe Maddon.
Well, the don't be uncomfortable just means don't get lazy. Don't just sort of sit back and relax and expect everything to just sort of happen. You know, you still have to work hard. You still have to remember that there is a target on you. Authenticity, I think, isn't something that he really had to say, but that's something that's really been a part of the Cubs from day one. These are good people, and they have to be true to themselves and do what they're capable of doing, not try to do too much, and good things will happen after that. The heartbeat element comes from Game 7 and the rain delay, the famous rain delay, when the game was tied against the Indians and Jason Hayward called the players into the weight room, and it was just the players. It was not any manager. It was not coaches. There was no video. There was no statistics. It was just Hayward getting the players together and just unifying them that way in a very organic type moment, very heartfelt moment, and that's the heartbeat that Maddon wants them to remember. You know, it's not always about statistics or breaking down video. Sometimes it's just, you know, sort of recognizing what's going on inside of you and making it work.
And they certainly made it work when it mattered most in Game 7. During that rain delay, that whole thing, that speech has already gone down in Cubs lore as something truly legendary and something to build on, of course, for 2017 as they look to repeat as world champions. And carry any designs for T-shirts yet with these things, or still a bit early for that, do you think?
I'm sure that Joe's got the prototypes. He did not reveal any of them to us. One of the players, Kyle Schwarber, was joking that one of the first things David Ross said after they won was turn the page, which meant it is time to move on and aim at 2017. So, of course, we were thinking they should have a T-shirt that said turn the page on the front and David Ross's picture on the back. Not sure if that's going to fly, but we're waiting. I'm sure Joe will have some. He's also prepped us to that there's going to be more. I don't like to say stunts because that makes it sound almost circus-like, but there will be more surprises this spring, and we should expect something on Sunday, which is the first day for the full squad workout. So I'm eager to see what happens then. Any fans in the Mesa area might want to stop by, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, expect the unexpected, of course, where Joe Maddon is concerned, and maybe somehow, some way, Grandpa Rossi makes his way onto a T-shirt in some way, shape, or form here as spring training wears on, and, of course, the 2017 season. And, Kerry, just to wrap up here, you had a very interesting conversation with one of the newer Cubs. John Jay, of course, spent many years with the Cardinals, and he's one of the few players on this team who has experience playing for a defending world champion as a member of the 2012 St. Louis Cardinals. Some of the other guys in that ilk are, you know, John Lester, John Lackey, Koji Uehara. So it's not a lot of guys that have played for a defending champion. Kind of highlight some of the points that he made to you about how things changed going from, you know, the hunter to the hunted now as a defending champion, and just what that's like for John Jay, having gone through that once, and maybe some of the wisdom, if you will, he can impart to this Cubs team as they kind of embark into uncharted waters here.
Well, I think we've kind of touched on it. It's really just a matter of keeping it simple and keeping the same approach. You know, they don't want to try and do too much. Jay said that one of the things that he noticed already being a newcomer in camp is that he can sense that the players are hungry. They're not talking about last year. They're not talking about, you know, the parades and you know, getting the keys to the city or going to Disneyland or anything like that. They're already focused on what's ahead. And that's, I think, goes back to a lot of what, you know, Maddon's also trying to emphasize and the themes here in camp. So it's just a matter of, you know, keeping that hunger and keeping the same approach, and they should do fine.
Yeah, everything.
One little note that you should know is that Jake Arrieta today revealed where he got the tattoo that he got in losing his bid with or his bet with Tommy La Stella. I know that Jake had posted a photo on Twitter of the CCU Coastal Carolina University tattoo. Mm-hmm. CCU beat Arietta's TCU team in the College World Series. Let's just say that Arietta's right cheek now has a new design on it.
I don't know what I could possibly say to top that, so we're going to end it right there. Carrie Luskett, a great anecdote to end things on for this week, and I'm sure it's going to be tough to top next week, but we'll certainly try. Thanks for the time, and we'll do it again soon. On that note, it's Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Chicago Cubs.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.